Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Steve Goldstein. I'm Lauren Gilger. Thank you for joining us this morning. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the children who legally work in our country's agricultural fields and why that is. And powerhouse Arizona restaurateur Sam Fox is selling his empire. We'll talk about what that means for the Valley's restaurant scene.
But first, a federal judge blocked the construction of what would be the third largest copper mine in the U.S. yesterday, halting plans to break ground on the Rosemont Mine in the Santa Rita Mountains, at least for now. The mining company Hudbay Minerals Incorporated is expected to appeal the decision to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. But for now, conservation groups and tribes that oppose the massive open pit mine are celebrating the decision that includes a repudiation of the Forest Service's longstanding interpretation of the 1872 mining law. Randy Seraglio is with the Center for Biological Diversity, one of the groups that's been fighting the mine, and joins us now. Randy, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's talk about the judge's ruling. What is in that ruling that makes this decision so important and perhaps so far-reaching?
Well, it really is a momentous precedent. The judge has said that the mining industry does not have an automatic right to just dump their toxic waste on our public lands. And the Forest Service, you know, they have always interpreted the mining law as assigning some sort of, you know, infinite rights to the industry on our public lands. And the judge said very clearly in this case that that is a misinterpretation of the law and that they have misinformed the public about that point.
So that could have very broad implications then, it sounds like, Randy. What other cases may be affected in the future?
Well, I mean, any project that is proposed for public land, such as this one, would be looked at through a new lens, and it's the correct lens, because the mining law was written in 1872, and, you know, 140 years ago, no one could envision the massive scale of these projects today that bury thousands of acres of public land under toxic waste, with a huge pit that's a mile wide and 3,000 feet deep. No such thing existed back then. And we've had any number of laws passed since then that govern how our public lands are managed, how they're conserved, how we balance different uses on public lands, protecting endangered wildlife and clean water and clean air. And the judge has said very clearly that the mining law does not trump all those other laws.
Well, as a layperson, when we hear a law from 1872, it does seem to sort of state the obvious in that there have been these changes, as you've talked about. So the Forest Service interpretation, the judge is taking issue with that. Again, I sort of piggyback on what Lauren just said about the far-reaching implications of this. Does this indicate that there's going to have to be deeper and deeper interpretation by different judges based on this mining law in other cases?
Well, this decision will be appealed, so the higher courts will weigh in on it. The Ninth Circuit will take a look at it first. Almost certainly the company will appeal it, but so we'll see where all that leads. But, you know, this is kind of a poster child for reform of the 1872 mining law, the Rosemont Mine proposal. And I'd like to, you know, emphasize that there's a long list of problems with this project, and there's, you know, many laws that are involved here. And the judge picked, you know, one specific issue that he thought was overarching, and he said it made the entire process flawed from its inception. And, you know, and the whole way that the Forest Service, you know, looked at this and ran their environmental impact statement process was illegal, basically. But he has yet to rule on all these other issues, problems with the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act, you know, other permits. So there's, you know, we're waiting for the judge to work his way through all these other very important legal issues. These modern large-scale copper mines create a host of problems with water contamination. They use a tremendous amount of water. This project is a major threat to Tucson's water security. It would use an immense amount of groundwater just taken right out from under our feet and turned into profit for a foreign mining company. And, you know, it's very clear that the judge thinks that we need to balance these impacts and these, you know, these the damages that would be done to our public lands and our public interest with, you know, the profits of a mining company.
All right. That's Randy Seraglio with the Center for Biological Diversity giving us the latest on the Rosemont mine decision. Randy, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
As of this week, the Bureau of Land Management has a new acting director, and environmental groups are being outspoken in their disappointment and concern. William Perry Pendley is an attorney who has supported selling public lands in the U.S. That comes on the heels of a letter from the Interior Department last month that other changes could be coming to the BLM, including a move of its headquarters from Washington, D.C. to Grand Junction, Colorado. With me to talk about the BLM's new acting director and his potential impact is Martin Nye, director of the Boley Center for People and Forests at the University of Montana. Martin, what's your reaction to the appointment of William Perry Pendley to lead the BLM?
I think it's incredibly significant to have someone lead the nation's largest federal land agency who doesn't believe in the constitutionality of federal public lands. The new director in the past has taken a number of positions and cases that are clearly antithetical to tribal interests, from sacred lands and cultural resource management to tribal reserved rights. And unclear to me at this point is how he is going to figure out how he is going to square those previous positions with his lawful duty and obligation in Interior to protect those tribal rights.
Clearly that means that that's the direction that the administration wants to go by appointing someone like that.
Well, there are three parts to this. And so, well, it has a long history, of course, but most recently, perhaps beginning in 2012, we saw what began in Utah as an effort to transfer the ownership of federal public lands to the states, something that quickly spread to every western state other than California, with proposals to do so. And the focus then was a transfer on ownership of federal lands to the states. That went nowhere, really. So the next chapter and the pivot was to the federal arena and to Congress. What we saw last year in the 115th Congress were a number of bills that, instead of focusing on the transfer of ownership to the states, focused on the transfer of management, control, and authority to state governments. And that's how I see that as part two of this act. And I think what happened with William Perry Pendley brings us to this next chapter, which is to place in senior leadership positions in the administration those that believe in the privatization of public lands.
What sort of changes would this, whether immediately or over the time period, bring about?
That's a difficult question as well, because the lands, leaders of the land seizure movement have conveniently avoided answering all the real questions pertaining to how transferred lands would in fact be managed. They have provided absolutely no policy details or guarantees in terms of planning or access, or public participation or accountability or anything. They talk about the efficiency of state land management and then conveniently forget to tell the people that, or remind the public that state trust lands are not in fact public lands as that is commonly understood by most Americans.
How different is the actual management between what the federal authorities do versus state?
Trust lands are not public lands, as that term is understood by most Americans. School trust lands have a very narrow mandate to generate revenue for a trust and for a beneficiary, which are most often the common schools or other public institutions of a state. Our federal land system is completely different, and of course the level of protection found within these systems varies considerably from a very preservation-oriented national park system to the multiple use mandates given to the Forest Service and the BLM. But one of the unifying common principles of federal public lands is that they are to be managed in the public and the national interest. So the two paradigms of management are completely different. And I think the land seizure movement has attempted to exploit the public's understanding of what constitutes public lands, and basically saying, hey, federal lands are mismanaged, the states can do so much more efficiently. But again, conveniently forget to tell the public about some of the details in terms of how those state trust lands are in fact managed. And then there's the big question of what most Western states have actually done with their original state trust lands, and that is to privatize and liquidate most of that acreage.
That is Martin Nye, director of the Bowley Center for People and Forests at the University of Montana.
The median cost of an immigration bond in Arizona today is $12,000. That marks an astronomical increase since 2006, when the median bond was set at just $60, according to data from Syracuse University's Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, which tracks a variety of immigration trends. Mo Goldman is an immigration lawyer in Tucson who has seen bonds climb higher and higher firsthand, and he joins us now to tell us more about it. Mo, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
So tell us, first of all, what you have observed here. Like, how much, in your experience, have you seen bonds go up?
Well, we've seen a market increase in the amount that's being required to be posted for a bond for someone who's in detention. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen any change as far as, you know, what the requirements are to show that an individual meets the basics to be released. So, for example, you know, if somebody is not a flight risk and not a danger to the community, the bond should be relatively low. And we've noticed over the last decade in my field of work that, in spite of the fact that many of the individuals are, you know, non-criminal and don't demonstrate any sort of flight risk, that the minimum amount for a bond has gone up quite considerably.
How high are bonds that you're seeing nowadays? Like, what is an average from your point of view?
We see a lot of them in the $10,000 to $20,000 range.
Wow.
There are some that could go up as high as $50,000 to even up to $80,000 in some cases. And in comparison, if we go back about a decade, many of the bonds were around $1,500 to $3,000 typically. Mm-hmm. The lowest that an immigration judge can require for a bond is $1,500. However, ICE, if in their discretion, can release an individual without even requiring a bond. And we saw a lot of that occur, especially around the end of President Obama's second term, where the priorities for holding individuals and deporting individuals was different than obviously it is today. And so you would see individuals who would get picked up in the same situation as they may be right now, and they would be released on their own recognizance. Hmm. And if it's today, you could be looking at anywhere between about $10,000 to $15,000 typically.
Can these folks afford this kind of high bond, $15,000, $12,000?
No. I mean, the bottom line is that they're, first of all, going to be put in a detention center in most cases that's far away from immigration attorneys. That's one issue that comes up, is that they're going to be isolated. The second problem is the amount that has to be posted is much higher than what any individual could typically get without the assistance of family or friends. And that obviously becomes an issue as well. I will note that if people do arrive at a port of entry or get caught in the desert trying to enter the U.S. and they ask for asylum, they could be, in most cases, subject to mandatory detention where they're not going to even be eligible for a bond. So that's something that we're seeing a much larger increase of today versus 2, 3, or 4 years ago, where individuals who would come in that sort of circumstance, they'd be paroled in, but they would be, in many cases, released on their own recognizance with the expectation that they would appear before ICE and check in with ICE and then appear for their hearing in front of the immigration court.
Mm-hmm. What is the rationale from the government and immigration officials behind this kind of increase in bond prices? Like you're saying, this is not necessarily applying to every single person who is, you know, has a criminal background or is a flight risk?
Yeah. I mean, it all ties into the idea of attrition through enforcement, that, you know, the idea that you make the policies more difficult for immigrants, the more likely that they'll give up and or just decide to try and fight their case only so far. And so what you'll see, unfortunately, is people will eventually decide that they don't want to be sitting in a prison and they'll throw in the towel. That's the reality. I mean, that's the reason why we're seeing higher bonds now, is because we're in a much higher level of enforcement than we were 3 or 4 years ago.
That's Mo Goldman, an immigration attorney with Goldman & Goldman in Tucson. Mo, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
The agriculture industry is a linchpin in our economy and literally provides us with much of the food on our tables, and it is supported by millions of workers who do the backbreaking work of harvesting it. And many of us don't realize hundreds of thousands of those workers are children. And the fact that they're doing this labor is perfectly legal. Independent journalists Valeria Fernandez and Karen Coates got a grant from the International Women's Media Foundation to dig into this issue. And their resulting story, The Young Hands That Feed Us, was recently published in Pacific Standard magazine. I spoke with them both more about it and began by asking about the time they spent in the fields with these children. What is the work like?
You know, we had the luxury of showing up at the time we would choose. So occasionally that was early in the morning, but often it was in the middle of the afternoon just for a short period. And by then the sun was blazing and it was so incredibly hot and the field was just vast. I mean, this was something that we heard over and over from farm workers describing their work, and it's just, the rows look endless. And we also had the luxury of leaving when we chose, but they would continue for hours beyond that.
And this work, surprisingly, I think, to me at least, often involves kids. I mean, you read that and you think, like, we don't allow child labor in the U.S. Like, this is not possible, but it, you're saying, is perfectly legal.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of exemptions in U.S. law, specifically when it comes to work in agriculture. So it's perfectly legal for you to be 12 years old and be working in a farm of any size for as long as your parents give permission. And actually, there's no limitation in the amount of hours that you could work. There is no overtime. And one thing that is important to clarify, that this is for as long as you're not missing school, right? So a lot of these kids are working during the summer, but this means that they would leave school early and come back to school late, really impacting their education.
And are they normally kind of working with their families? Is that how this works?
The children talked about that, how the idea was to stick together with the family. I mean, it was a family job, a family affair, and it was the idea that everybody was working together to help each other.
Yeah. What kind of income are they able to make on this? Like, is this an industry where the minimum wage applies?
There are a lot of exceptions to what farm workers are supposed to be paid, depending on the size of the farm and all sorts of factors. But often it ends up that farm workers are not paid minimum wage, especially if they're being paid by like a piece rate. So, and for children too, under 16, if they're working by the piece rate, which is, you know, calculated by, say, a crate of onions picked or bundles, you know, 100 bundles of cilantro, something like that, what they end up making often does not end up being minimum wage, and often what children are making goes into sort of the household income.
And how extensive is this here in the U.S.? Can you get a sense of how many children are involved?
Yeah, I mean, we got different statistics, right? I think it's from the Government Accountability Office. We know that about 500,000 children work every year in agriculture. But what's interesting and the focus of a story is about these, you know, 300,000 or so children that migrate every year. Mm-hmm. And when we say migrate, we mean that they're working within the United States. So they're going from the Rio Grande Valley, taking a journey that takes 3 days with their family to go work in Michigan, to go to work in Illinois, to work in Wisconsin, in these farms, you know, for several months, sometimes dropping out of school.
So let's talk about school and how this affects these kids' lives. You visited one of the schools that has a lot of these kids in it, but you also talked to some students who go in the summer. How likely is it that they are going to end up finishing their degree, and how much harder is it for them?
It's a lot harder. So children who work in agriculture and migrate, the schools have migrant counselors to sort of help them pave the way, and then also connect them with education and schools and teachers in whatever area that they're migrating toward. But often, you know, kids fall through the cracks, and for one reason or another, they drop out or they just don't finish the year, and then they start falling behind, and it's really hard for them to catch up.
Yeah. And another thing that it was shared with us, because it's this generational, you know, it's been happening for a long time. The migrant program was created in the 1960s. And we interviewed a migrant counselor who actually was a migrant child himself. It's always been hard. You know, there's been a lot of discrimination towards these children. And still, even today, they're going to states where maybe they don't have a lot of population of color, and they face a lot of hurdles trying to, you know, take tests or enroll in school. And in between all the bureaucracy, sometimes they end up not being able to enroll and take those credits that they need in order to graduate in time.
Hmm. And beyond that, like, how dangerous of an industry is this for kids? I mean, you talk about what Human Rights Watch says about this industry and about child labor in this way. And what did you find there?
Well, what we found is that more than half of work-related deaths in children happen in agriculture, even though they are 6% of the number of children working.
And also, an average of 33 children per day are injured in agricultural work. And although this wasn't the focus of our story, a lot of these accidents happen, say, when very young children are driving tractors or machinery on farms. Mm-hmm. And it also happens among children who are in the field who aren't actually doing the work. So often parents will bring children to the field if the parents are working. But even if the kids are really young, there are cases of, like, children being run over by trucks if they're, you know, hanging out around the cars and people just can't see them. Really sad, sad stories.
Yeah. And I mean, in any other industries, you have to be at least 18 years of age to be operating some of this machinery. Mm-hmm. And in agriculture, it's like 16 years of age.
So if you have an organization like Human Rights Watch saying this is horrendous and should not exist, but it's the parents allowing or asking the children to participate in this, how do you sort of reconcile that in terms of the parents' rights in the family and also what those families need?
None of the parents that we spoke with really enjoy or love having the children having to work. Mm-hmm. But it's a family effort. They helping each other. And the fact that these children are coming to work is also supporting in a way their education and providing a gateway or an opportunity for them to get out of this type of work. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the money that kids make go to school supplies. It goes towards their education. And they have that understanding too. So I think is a lot of your human rights organizations, what they're saying is pay the parents a fair living wage, pay them overtime, give them benefits. They don't even have health care benefits. And then we can start talking, because there wouldn't be that need mm-hmm. for the children to come and work.
The consumer is part of this too. And economic research shows that as little as about $21 a year extra per consumer could be enough extra money to pay farm workers enough that it would raise them above the poverty line.
Right. Karen Coates and Valeria Fernandez, their article, The Young Hands That Feed Us, appears in Pacific Standard Magazine. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good Thursday morning. It's The Show in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. And Lauren, You've noticed a little muggy in here, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. It's definitely sticky, but, you know, my skin's looking great, so.
It certainly is. No, I can vouch for that. Monsoon season has arrived in the Valley just in time for our monsoon stories, and that means we need your help. This year, we're telling stories about how the monsoon storms tickle our five senses, how they look, feel, sound, smell, and taste.
And there are plenty of ways you can participate. Just go to monsoon.kjzz.org and submit your best monsoon photo. We have a pretty cool slideshow of those going. Or call us, 480-774-8299 is the number, and share your story. You could end up on air.
Arizona lawmakers are doing well in some areas of cancer prevention, but less well in others. That comes from a report released this morning by the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. The state earns a green ranking in the top group of states in areas like Medicaid eligibility, cigarette excise tax rates, and smoke-free legislation. But it gets lower marks in categories including state tobacco control funding, laws banning kids from using tanning devices, and pain management policies. Elise Patel is the Arizona grassroots manager for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. She spoke with our co-host Mark Brody Moore about the 17th How Do You Measure Up report, which looks at state legislative policies to reduce cancer incidence and mortality.
In general, how is Arizona doing in terms of enacting policies that try to reduce the risk of its residents getting cancer?
You know, we're doing well in some areas, and we definitely have room for improvement in others. This year, we are excited because the How Do You Measure Up report did a special section focusing on our tobacco control work and trying to help curb the tobacco youth epidemic. So we worked on a lot of policy this year focused on trying to raise the age of tobacco sale to 21. You know, e-cigarettes have driven a dramatic 36% rise in youth tobacco product over the last year. And lung cancer is actually the deadliest form of cancer in Arizona. So this is an opportunity that we have a lot of progress to make.
Well, so this was sort of a big issue, especially at the end of the legislative session, where there were proposals to raise the tobacco age to 21, but that would also ban cities and towns from enacting their own regulations. There was a competing bill that would have required vaping products to be considered and regulated the same as tobacco products. In the end, neither of those passed, so we're basically left with the status quo. How does that sort of fit in with the overall picture that you found in Arizona?
Yeah, so unfortunately, our good faith efforts of trying to do the health approach to solving this tobacco epidemic was, you know, taken advantage of by the tobacco industry and disguised a tobacco 21 bill really aimed at interfering with our tobacco control and protecting their profits. And what they tried to do, the scary part is they would have overturned a 20-year-old law that prevented the possession of use of tobacco on school campuses. So we were really glad that we were able to work, you know, with our community partners and other health organizations and school superintendents at overcoming this bill so that it couldn't pass. But at the same time, like you mentioned, we were disappointed that we were unable to push our good bill with evidence-based strategies to the finish line.
So what is your plan for 2020? I mean, which approach are you trying to take? What kind of policies would you like to see the state enact?
So we'll continue to work on public policy strategies that help increase access to care and also a big focus on cancer prevention. And we have seen a lot of momentum in the tobacco control area. So we're hoping to continue to improve on that and take what we have learned from this past session into play in 2020. And we're also hoping that this report will give insight to our lawmakers on how they can help Arizona and the fight against cancer in areas that we would be happy to work with them on.
In terms of the overall picture on cancer in Arizona, when you talk about tobacco and lung cancer and that kind of thing, how big of a piece of it is that relative to other policies the state could potentially enact that might reduce cancer risks?
I would say it's a very large aspect. You know, you look at the cost that tobacco has on our healthcare system, and there's a lot of lung cancer is the deadliest form of cancer here in Arizona. So we know that there's a lot of suffering as a result of tobacco use. But that's not to say that our other areas in regards to access to care or indoor tanning and palliative care, those are also crucial areas that we can continue to work on. And any avenue that we can help reduce suffering from cancer, you know, we are ready to arm our advocates and our volunteers to help in this fight.
I know that Arizona, according to the report, has been doing better. I'm wondering where it falls in terms of other states around the country. Like, how are Arizona's policies compared to other states?
There's actually, they found that 18 states are falling behind, reaching only a green status in two or fewer of the priority areas that were named in this report. And three of our states actually met green benchmarks in six of the eight categories. But currently, none of our states across the United States have received a green ranking in seven or eight of these policies. So, you know, I would say that, unfortunately, we only have three that are considered green, but I think that we do have a lot of rooms for improvement in the other categories as well.
And when you look at trying to prevent cancer risks or minimize risks anyway, in general, how much does policy come into it and how much does sort of individual behaviors and choices that we as residents make in terms of trying to minimize those risks?
They both play a very crucial role. And I think that public policy helps educate people and give an overall stance to how we can improve. But it does come back down to a lot of individuals and educating them on the ways that they can help live healthy lives and take preventative measures to help reduce the risk of getting cancer.
All right. That's Elise Patel, Arizona Grassroots Manager for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. Elise, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Mark.
Big news in the restaurant industry today. Sam Fox, the powerhouse Arizona restaurateur, sold his dining empire, Fox Restaurant Concepts, to the Cheesecake Factory Incorporated for a whopping $308 million cash. According to the Arizona Republic, Fox will continue to lead the company from its headquarters here in Phoenix, but it will become a wholly owned subsidiary of the mega company. So what does this mean for the Valley restaurant scene? For a little perspective on that, we turn now to retired longtime Arizona restaurant critic Howard Seftel. And Howard, I want to start just with your reaction to this sale. Does this surprise you at all?
Yes and no. I have to tell you, Lauren, I have enormous respect for Sam Fox as a businessman. He is, and I'm not tossing this word around lightly, he's a genius. This man has his finger on the pulse of the American mass market. And he has spun off a few restaurants over the past few years. So it's not that he's never relinquished control of his restaurants. Giving up everything, I think, is sort of astonishing, but he has 308 million reasons to do this. So that's an offer that's hard to refuse.
So give us a sense. So you, I'm sure, kind of watched Sam Fox's rise as he, you know, launched this sort of what's become a mini empire in restaurants here. Give us a sense of the story behind this. Like, what was this like to watch?
It's not a mini empire, Lauren. It's an empire. He is a fabulous entrepreneur who, for 20 years, he started, I believe, in the late 90s in Tucson. But for 20 years, this man has had his finger on the pulse of the zeitgeist, if that makes any sense. And he serves absolutely appealing middle American food to people who I would call them aspirational diners. These aren't people who want to go to some chef and look at ingredients that maybe they've never heard of, or spend $32 on a main dish where they're not quite sure what they're eating, or who don't recognize a couple of appetizers. That's a little too scary. But they also don't want to necessarily just be, you know, people who eat tuna fish. So he has a range, or had a range of restaurants that appealed across the spectrum of middle American tastes, from hamburgers to health. I mean, he got on the health food craze almost before anybody and parlayed it into a fabulous concept, True Food Kitchens. He hit the sweet spot of American tastes.
So what does this mean locally in terms of the restaurant scene here where he's been such a powerhouse for such an amount of time, right? Like, and what does it mean that this won't be locally owned anymore?
Here is the biggest takeaway from this, and this is not going to be the answer you expect. But I think right now most of the restaurant owners and chefs in town are happy. And the reason is Sam Fox always paid more than other places for their labor. They paid a premium. And they, in this town where labor, restaurant labor, is incredibly tight, Sam Fox sucked up the best labor force because he paid them more. Now, will the Cheesecake Factory, this, you know, multi-giant squid of a complex, do the same thing? I don't know. If they're smart, they will. Sam Fox has a great reputation. Mm-hmm. People like him. They know he's brilliant. But he was very hard to compete with.
So this will mean, you think, for the food scene here, that maybe it'll leave a little bit of breathing room for other chefs to come in and fill that space?
Yes. By the same token, Sam Fox gave lots of good chefs good jobs and people in the restaurant industry good jobs. So for the industry as a whole, I don't know if it's a plus or a minus. Hmm. He was nominated as Restaurateur of the Year for the James Beard Foundation, I don't know, 10 times. And he's still a young man, so I don't think he's going to retire to Tahiti and count his $308 million over and over. But if he opens another place and it becomes public, my advice would be to buy stock and eat someplace else.
All right. That is Howard Seftal, retired longtime restaurant critic for the Arizona Republic. Howard, thank you for coming on.
Sure. Quite welcome. Bye-bye, Lauren.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm DeWitt Perry. Basically, my specialty is underwater repairs, and we have a pool repair and service. After we set everything together, we turn our air on, and then we look at our pressure gauge, and then jump right into it. Underwater, and put your finger in there. You get every critter and everything, and sometimes people tend to forget what they leave in the swimming pool. You can spend all day long and have fun. Blowing bubbles is what we call it in the business.
That's DeWitt Perry fixing a pool underwater. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to tell us to take a dive, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org. Districts, educators, and parents in Arizona are working to improve how students are learning, even with continued funding shortfalls. There are areas of agreement and disagreement, but most seem on board to push for some kind of change. That's part of the series Arizona Republic Digital Opinions editor Joanna Allhands has been writing. She's focusing on what steps will, quote, move the needle, and is with me to talk specifically about school size. That doesn't necessarily mean class size, but the actual size of the buildings. Joanna, why can the size of the school building itself make a difference in the learning environment for students?
I'll be clear that the research on this is actually pretty limited, so it's not very scientifically sound. They haven't done a lot of like long-term studies. There's just a few out there, and they tend to focus more on the high school years than like in elementary and stuff. But one of the things that we have found, the academic benefits, some schools have done really, really well. You get smaller schools and the kids just flourish, you know. Other schools, it's been kind of mixed. And to be quite honest, we don't really know why.
Okay.
The academic benefits are kind of in, but there's some more intangible benefits of smaller schools. And one especially, it just sort of makes sense, is if you're in a really large environment, especially in a high school where the kids are not in the same classroom all day with the same teacher and the same students with them. I mean, they're kind of moving from classroom to classroom. When you have really big environments like that, they can get pretty impersonal, and it's really easy for kids to fall through the cracks, especially kids that may be having some, you know, issues, either things at home, like we've talked about before, you know, or just socioeconomic kind of stuff that might be a challenge, or just that they don't fit in, or they don't feel like, you know, I'm really learning anything, or I'm really not, you know, really challenged by my classes. In a larger environment, that can sort of be exacerbated. And here in Arizona, we have really big schools.
Why do we have big schools?
Well, really, it's an economic thing. It really is. You know, we were growing so fast and there were so many kids, and it was just like, oh my gosh, you know, we have got to get these schools built today because we can't wait on the growth. I mean, it's, you know, schools were really just trying to keep afloat. And so the best way that they could do that was to build really ginormous schools that they could shove as many students in as possible because they just didn't have time. And so really, you know, I think probably in slower growth times, maybe with some of the very old schools, there was kind of this time to sort of sit back and talk about, like, what kind of environment do we want and how do we want to build these things and that sort of thing. Although, of course, the building style even of some of the very old buildings really doesn't match how we teach these days. So that's a whole other issue. But, you know, really a lot of that introspective kind of thought process really didn't happen because we were just growing so fast. And so schools were just, it was like, this is the school formula that worked. This is what we got. We got, you know, we, especially in the school facilities board days, once that came along and there were requirements to get funding, it was like, just spit them out. Let's just get these schools and go along.
You mentioned there's not that much research in terms of the size of schools, but are there obvious reasons or maybe not so obvious reasons as to why there was a trend, or at least maybe there's a continuing trend, to have smaller schools in different parts of the country? I understand the Gates Foundation had some issue with that.
Yeah, well, the Gates Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, they had this whole initiative where they were convinced that if we build a bunch of small schools, they focus more on high schools, and it was in kind of the 500 student realm, that if we do that, we're going to see this huge transformation. And there were two problems with that. One, I think Gates overpromised. There are no silver bullets in education. You can't just do something and be like, suddenly we fixed education. That doesn't happen. So there was an expectation level there that was just wrong. I think with a lot of the grants that they had, it was very top down. And so it was like they were sort of imposing on different districts, and every district is different. Kids have different needs. They were just basically saying, like, you do this thing, and, you know, some it worked and some it didn't. So then everybody was like, oh my gosh, you know, the Gates Foundation, they spent billions of dollars and this was a total failure. Well, it was and it wasn't. There were some real successes, and yes, there were some failures. And so I think we kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater in that a little bit. I think, you know, and I think that's just the way it is with education, is we're very much like, if we don't have an immediate result, we just want to like throw things out and be like, well, that didn't work. And then we go on to something else. And so we're kind of like, you know, that scene in the movie Up where it's like, squirrel, squirrel, squirrel. That's what we're doing. You know, we're just looking over here and like, here's this new education trend. Let's do that in here. And so that is sort of what happened, I think, with the small schools idea. It had a good core, and we didn't stick with it long enough, and we were just looking for what's the new silver bullet.
Well, you had some suggestions, and I wanted to ask you about one, or at least they're listed as lessons, but to use the right wording, consider schools within schools. That's intriguing to me.
Yeah, and so this is a very new idea, and so we don't really have a ton of evidence to know, like, or really to point to and be like, this is the move, you know, this is how it needs to go. But Phoenix Union is rethinking these ginormous campuses that they have. And, you know, they started doing this several years ago where they were coming up with these micro schools that are kind of, you know, focused on certain areas like aerospace or police or, you know, coding and that sort of thing. And so they've kind of taken that concept of having these little tiny, really focused programs. And they've said, well, what if we took a giant school that's, by the way, not full anymore, and what if we put several of those academies in one school? And so it kind of functions like a university, like you're in a college in a university. So say, like, I majored in journalism, right? I was in the journalism school. I took a lot of classes through the journalism school, But then, you know, you could still be in the band. You were still, you know, playing sports and whatever. You can do all that kind of stuff through the larger school, but you're part of this smaller academy. So you have a cohort of students that's much smaller. You're with the same kind of kids, you know, every day. You're kind of focused on a certain area like aerospace or something like that. That's what they're thinking. Now, granted, it's not cheap to do this. And, you know, the way that this, the state money, the school facilities board money does not cover these kind of renovations. Mm-hmm. So schools have to shoulder this kind of thing themselves. There's been a huge response from the community already. I mean, even just in a year that they've really had this going at South Mountain High School, which was the first one where they've done this school within a school within a school within a school thing, they've just had a huge response. They have a wait list now.
Joanna Allhands is digital opinions editor for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. We've been talking about the latest in her Moving the Needle education series. Good to see you. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.